You can imagine that this is a highly popular passage for preachers. One of those that can get you into trouble. But it illustrates, I mean, I said a couple weeks ago that Jesus does not set God's law aside. He doesn't come and replace it and start doing something else. Instead, he takes it and he intensifies it. That he goes beyond merely the surface requirements to the deeper meaning and purpose and principle, which is the foundation of the law and for which it was given. And we saw that last week, if you were here, as we looked at the law against murder. And I pointed out last week that in doing this, Jesus is taking the scribes and the Pharisees head on, because they taught the law and they followed the law pretty much at the straight, literal level. They refused to ask if their interpretations of God's law were consistent with God's purpose in giving the law. And we see that very clearly in our passages from Matthew this morning. And to underscore that, we're actually going to take our passage from Matthew 5 back to front. We'll take it in reverse order, so we can really see more clearly what Jesus is doing with the law over against the religious leaders of his day. Because when we look at the law that Moses gave regarding divorce, we didn't read it this morning, it's in Deuteronomy 24, we need to understand two things. Indeed, there are two things that are very critical for us to understand so that we see what's actually going on with the passage in Deuteronomy, which otherwise seems very strange, very alien, very harsh. One, divorce was rampant and uncontrolled in the ancient world. It was something that was done for even the most frivolous of reasons. I mean, people talk about the divorce rate now, but honestly, we had nothing on, you know, some of the cultures of a few thousand years ago. And two, divorce was something that men did to women, not the other way around. You know, you have a society, and it's pretty much true the further back you go in history, you have a society where, you know, men had all the ownership, all the power, pretty much all of everything. And you'll notice that that mindset is still there in the Pharisees. They don't ask, is it lawful for a couple to get a divorce? Which is how we in our modern world would phrase it. They say, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? This is not an accident. And those two statements are not synonymous. Divorce was something men did to women. And the law was given through Moses in Deuteronomy in large part to protect women from that reality. One, it established that a man couldn't divorce his wife simply because somebody prettier came along. He couldn't divorce his wife simply because he got tired of her elbowing him at night. He had to prove some major moral failure on her part. There had to be something real and significant going on to justify it. And two, any man who divorced his wife had to give her a written statement that he had done so. And the way that the law worked, he had to give it to her in the presence of two witnesses, which prevented him or anyone else from accusing her of being a runaway or a prostitute or whatever other ugly idea someone might come up with. And never underestimate the ability of people to come up with the worst explanation for something and believe it even if it's implausible. But with the statement and the witnesses that she could go to, she had proof that she had not, in fact, done anything, you know, that would be wrong as far as the eyes of the law, you know, as far as justifying any sort of punishment. And three, if you look at Deuteronomy, it says that any man who divorces his wife is forbidden to remarry her. And that might seem harsh, but it also serves this purpose, because it drives the point home for any man who might be tempted that divorce is nothing to be done lightly. It is nothing to be taken lightly. It's not something you can do on a spur of the moment and figure, well, if you change your mind, you can just change your mind and undo it. No, this is something that you need to be very, very sure you absolutely have to do before you take that step. But also, of course, this law was given to protect God's institution of marriage, in the exception that Deuteronomy makes and Jesus affirms. When there is a catastrophic moral failure within a marriage, such that the relationship is defiled, then divorce is permitted because it's a recognition of the death of the relationship which has already occurred. And note this, Moses does not command divorce. Jesus does not command it. Jesus came to make dead people live. And he can raise marriages from the dead just as well. But it's the reality. We can only control what we do. We can't control what anyone else does. We can't control both ends of any of our relationships. And so there are situations that arise for which God allows divorce as the best of a bad set of options. Now, as we get to this point, people tend to want to start laying out, okay, you know, what's permitted and what's not, and what are the rules, and you know, let's lay out the lines and figure out, you know, what goes here and what goes there. And we could be here a fairly long time. I mean, that would be a sermon in and of itself, and that's not the sermon I'm trying to preach. So let me just say briefly that the word that Jesus uses here in Matthew 5 and also in Matthew 19 is not the word for adultery. That's in the first half of Matthew 5 when he's talking about that. But it's a broader word for sexual immorality. And if you really dig into it, you really lay it out and begin to explore, I think it's safe to say that his point here encompasses what one of my mentors used to call the four A's. Adultery, abuse, addiction, and abandonment. And I'm not, like I said, I'm not going to take the time to lay out why that is and how that all fits together and give you all the biblical arguments. I'm just going to say that what is in view here, the fundamental concern that Jesus is expressing, that the law expresses, is dealing with anything that breaks faith at the root with the person to whom one is married. Any sin that ruptures the relationship at its core. And again, divorce is not commanded in those circumstances, but there are times when, you know, it is simply the reality of the case. You know, it simply expresses what has already happened and is not changing. But what I want to point you to is the difference between this position that Jesus takes, you know, and the view that he expresses, you know, of marriage and divorce and of our relationships with each other, and compare that to the attitude that the Pharisees are expressing, that we see implicitly in Matthew 5 and that they lay out explicitly in chapter 19. Because they come to Jesus in chapter 19. Of course, I mean, they're trying to get him in trouble. You know, this is, by this point in time in the Gospels, this is their entire agenda with Jesus. They're trying to get him in trouble. They're trying to find some sort of label that they can use to try to bring him down. This is classic politics. This is negative campaigning at its best. They want a soundbite that they can put, you know, in one of those ads that they'll show 24/7 on CNN. And they come to him, and they're getting him in this argument about marriage and everything else, and they say, well, okay, Moses commanded divorce. So why are you contradicting the law? And in that question, what we can see is exactly how fouled up their understanding of the whole situation was. Because what Moses had actually commanded is, if you divorce your wife, then you must give her a certificate. That's the only command involved in Moses. But from their point of view, that's what's important about the law. Moses said, you divorce your wife, you give her the paperwork. You know, and so they're very careful. You know, they give her the paperwork. Well, never mind you what the paperwork is supposed to be for. Never mind what marriage is supposed to be for, what any of this is really supposed to be all about in God's eyes. Never mind God's original intention in Genesis that Jesus has just been talking about. Moses says, you give her a certificate of divorce. And then and taking that and making that the whole and the sum of Moses' point, they've taken the rest of the law and they've twisted it into a pretzel. And to be fair, the Pharisees as we see them here are not representative of all Pharisees. There's actually a divide. In fact, there's one major divide right down the center of the group of Pharisees at this point in time. Two great teachers, Shammai and Hillel. And Shammai and his followers were trying to hold the line against the culture on this one. Yeah, and they were insisting that the only proper grounds for adultery was unfaithfulness. But then you have, you know, the other great teacher, Hillel, who is really kind of, you know, he and his school are kind of rising to the primary position. You know, Hillel's greatest student is Gamaliel, whom we meet in Acts. Gamaliel's most famous student is a guy named Saul, who we later come to know as Paul. But Hillel taught that when the law said indecency, you know, if any indecency had been found in her, meant that he may divorce her even if she spoiled a dish for him. A little bit later, a century or two later, one of his descendants among the Pharisees, the great Rabbi Akiva, who's quoted all over the place in Judaism, would add, even if he found another fairer than she. In other words, according to a certain stream of Jewish thought that is developing at this point, if your husband finds somebody prettier than you, that makes you morally culpable. It's probably possible to get more screwed up than that, but you'd really have to work at it. This is the sort of thing that the law was given to prevent. And they have twisted it up so thoroughly that they're using the law to justify it. And in fact, you're trying to argue that the law requires it. Why? Because they want to live by the law. They want to be convinced and to have everybody else convinced that they are righteous because they are keeping the law. But they don't actually want the law to bite too deep. They don't want the law to be harder to keep than they really feel like dealing with. They don't want the law to be bigger than they're really capable of handling. And this is what happens when we try to live only by law. When we make law the measure by which we judge our lives. Because sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously, we will begin to shrink the law down to our preferred size. Down to where we find its measure comfortable to us. We look for ways to justify the things we want to do. And then we interpret the law to include our self-justifications. It's the sort of thing Benjamin Franklin was talking about when he observed that the great thing about being a rational creature is that one can always find a reason for whatever it is one already intends to do. And this works on a lot of levels. It really works on every level. You know, if you're a Supreme Court justice, you use words like penumbras and emanations to accomplish this purpose. If you're an ordinary schmo like us, you're not really working at that vocabulary level, but you probably do tell the cop once in a while, okay, so yeah, technically I was speeding, but the conditions are good, the road is straight, I can see, it was perfectly safe. There's no reason I should have to do 55. Whatever ways we might find to do it, whatever is convenient in the moment, that's what we try to do. We readjust and we reinterpret until we've got the law lined up with wherever we've decided we already want to be. And we don't see. We refuse to see the damage that we do in the process as we sail merrily along doing as we please. See, once again, the law is not fundamentally about behavior, because we can almost always find a way to rationalize doing what we want to do, even when we've been told not to do it. Something which I've known for a long time, but really didn't fully appreciate until I had children. And in some ways, I think only fully appreciate now that I have four, because the fourth one is the most creative about this. Granted, at a two-year-old rational level, but still. You know, I mean, you say, do not do X. And immediately you start getting back all sorts of arguments as to why you're wrong and they ought to be allowed to do it. And you say, no, don't do this. And you come back an hour later and they've done it. And you call them down and you say, didn't I tell you not to do this? And say, well, I didn't. Yes, you did. It's right there. No, I didn't do that. I did da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's the same thing, just different words. It's just sort of defined a little bit differently. And you say, well, no, this is the same thing. That doesn't count. They say, well, yeah, but you said this, and this is why I did it. And, you know, here are the reasons why it was perfectly... No. Let's boil this back down. I said no. I said don't. All these other things have nothing to do with that. I said don't do that, and you did it. And they walk away feeling like they were perfectly justified, and I'm being unreasonable. Because I can't see that I didn't tell them to do that, and if I did, I shouldn't have. And even if I did and should have, they didn't do it anyway. There's always another layer. There's always something more to the onion. And the thing is, when I'm honest, if I look in the mirror, I mean, I have my 2-year-old, I have my 7-year-old. I'm turning 40 this year. Am I any different? I try to be, but sometimes I'm not. I just use bigger words. I mean, I got enough degrees. I got a lot of bigger words. But again, you boil them all down, doesn't matter how many syllables it's got. The essence of the thing doesn't change. And the essence of it is that what matters is not that we can justify that we have somehow managed to line up on just this side of the fence. What matters is the state of our relationship with God and our relationships with those whom we love and who love us and to whom we owe faithfulness and honor and respect. And for that, everything matters. You know, there are few concepts in our society more pernicious than that of the victimless crime. There is no such thing as a victimless crime. And I said last week, we do not exist as isolated individuals. Everything that affects us affects everyone around us, affects everyone that we're in relationship with. Everything we do and everything that happens to us, everything even that we do to ourselves, sends ripples out into the lives of all those around us, and from them to those around them, and so on and so on. You know, the relevant question is never just, is this something that if I got caught doing it, I could be prosecuted? Whether at a legal level, or at a level of family rules, or whatever it might be. But the real question, this really comes back to something we talked about several weeks ago when we were talking about the Beatitudes and the statement, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. That righteousness is a relationship word. It's about all the relationships in our lives, first and foremost our relationship with God, that each have right and proper claims on us. And whether we are honoring those claims that others have on us, whether we are honoring their reasonable expectations for what we have committed to them. And being righteous is being in a state where we are right with our commitments to God, where we are right with our commitments to each other, where we are honoring the commitments that we have made and where we are keeping the promises we have made and where we are being faithful to those who have a right to our faithfulness. That is the relevant concern. And the question is, will doing this, or will thinking about this, make my heart pure toward God, toward my wife or husband, toward my children, boyfriend or girlfriend, brother or sister, friend, boss, coworker, whoever it might be? Will it strengthen my relationship with him, with them? Will it strengthen that which is good in my life? Will it strengthen those relationships which are healthy and make them healthier? Or will it not? You know, both the Old and the New Testaments go beyond simply talking about marriage for its own sake to use it as an image of God's love for his people. As indeed all of our relationships are supposed to be. But marriage being sort of the purest and the most obvious and in many ways the most difficult example. Because it's supposed to be the deepest and most all-encompassing commitment that we ever make to another human being. A pledge of exclusive devotion to one another with every aspect of our lives. To put one another ahead of ourselves and everyone else on the face of this planet for as long as life shall last. And Jesus said, greater love has no one than this, than a man lay down his life for his friends. You know, and at the highest level, if what my wife needed for me was to die for her, then that's what God asks of me. Fortunately, by the grace of God, she doesn't at this point. I think she's glad of that most days too. But that only underscores the fact that to her, second only to Christ, what God asks is a living sacrifice. Not to lay down my life in death, but to lay it down in every other way in service. And then after her, my children and this church and everyone else. And we all have, you know, those hierarchies of commitment, those people to whom we owe that sort of service, to whom we owe our lives to one degree or another. And yes, we know that people are frequently unfaithful. Yes, we know that sometimes people make that commitment, which is supposed to be until death do them part, and strive to keep it only to find it shattered on the other end. And so divorce happens. You can't make somebody else be faithful. You can't make somebody else be honorable. And yes, there are those who have in the past been the destroyers, and who are now trying to follow Christ faithfully. And they, like all the rest of us, are sinners saved by grace. It's not the unforgivable sin. There are no unforgivable sins save the ultimate rejection of God, of Jesus Christ. You know, none of us have yet encountered the doctor to have a blue post box, or police box rather, that can allow us to travel back in time and somehow undo what we've done. All we can do is go forward, try to make amends as we have the opportunity, accept the grace of God and realize that we cannot justify ourselves, but we don't need to, that we are justified in Christ, and show that grace to others. But how we go forward is the point. That we not try to justify our sin. That we not construct our lives the rest of the way, just piling decision upon decision upon decision in an effort to convince ourselves or somebody else that really it wasn't wrong what we did. But instead, ruthlessly cutting out of our lives anything that tends to draw our hearts away from God. And anything that poisons our relationships with those we love and with those who love us. No, Jesus didn't literally physically mean that you should go around with one eye and one hand. That's a metaphor. But the power and the violence of that metaphor should really drive home exactly how serious Jesus is about this. Whatever there is in our lives that pulls us to sin, that pulls us away from God, that draws us into breaking our commitments and breaking our relationships, whatever we have to do to cut it out, we need to do. For those of us who are married, obviously after God, we owe this most to our wife or husband. Beyond that, parents and children, to the church, to friends. And no, this does not mean that any time we feel temptation, we're guilty of sin. You know, I remember having some of these conversations back in junior high, and I mean, a couple of my friends who were, you know, absolutely convinced that, you know, they were going to go to hell because, you know, they'd been having certain thoughts about the girl sitting in front of them in math class. And that's not the point. Luther was right. We can't stop the birds of temptation from flying over our heads. But as he continued, we can keep them from building a nest in our hair. You know, and that we're responsible to do. And here's the thing, and here's the point really that we need to emphasize most, which is that this is not just another law. This is not just another, you know, don't do this. You know, this is not just another sit down and beat ourselves up. First and foremost, how do we do this? Well, it's what we sang about earlier. Be thou my vision, O Lord of my heart. It's not just about what we don't look at, what we don't think about. Or else we wind up like the ancient vizier who was given a flying carpet that only worked as long as he didn't think about the word elephant. You know, eventually all you think about is elephants. If you're just trying to do it negatively. We look to Jesus. We go to him in prayer. We look to his word. We focus our eyes and our minds and our hearts on him. We focus ourselves on the gospel of his grace. We seek him first. Let him fill our lives with his love and his goodness. We let him teach us to love better the things of God than the things of the world. And we let his Spirit drive the rest out. Let's pray.